It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The different aspects of internet defamation relate to the method and manner by which the information is distributed and the methods used to make certain comments public. More public than, for instance, just being carried in the local newspaper. Because the only people that are going to learn about that type of defamation are those who read the paper or their friends mention it to them. With the internet, there are ways to distribute the information in a much more broad way so that a comment made today on the internet in here in Richmond could be picked up in Hollywood or New York or Moscow the next hour or so.
Private attorney John Dozier talks about internet defamation and why addressing such online defamation is important, and just how poor you have to be to get benefits under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, formerly food stamps, is discussed during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 148, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Military personnel whose homes were improperly foreclosed upon will each receive at least $116,875 from BAC Home Loans Servicing, a subsidiary of Bank of America, for alleged violations of the Service Member Civil Relief Act, or SCRA. Compensation also will be obtained by service members for any equity lost from the bank's infringement of the law as part of the settlement. BAC Home Loans Servicing, formerly known as Countrywide Home Loans Servicing, illegally foreclosed the homes of approximately 160 service members between January 2006 and May 2009. The bank agreed to pay a total of $20 million as compensation for the individuals who lost their properties, the largest settlement ever since the SCRA was enacted in December 2003. The SCRA provides additional consumer protection to the men and women who are serving in the military. The law forbids lenders from foreclosing on active-duty military members and caps their interest rate on all pre-existing consumer debt at 6%. Service members impacted by the bank's violation of the SCRA started receiving letters on November 14 notifying them of their compensation under this settlement. In other news, on November 4, the Supreme Court of Virginia ruled that the 20-year statute of limitations on enforcing judgments bars the Division of Child Support Enforcement, or DCSE, from collecting delinquent child support payments that are more than 20 years old. The parties were divorced in October 1966, and the father was ordered to pay the mother $30 per week in child support until their three minor children became adults. The child support obligation ended in June 1982. In June 2006, the mother asked DCSE to enforce the child support due and unpaid from 1967 to 1982, and DCSE asked the circuit court to do so. The father pleaded the statute of limitations as a defense. Both the circuit court and the Court of Appeals ruled that the statute of limitations did not bar collection of child support and set an arrearage of $73,629. However, the Supreme Court of Virginia reversed, holding that each installment payment ordered by the court in its 1966 divorce decree became a judgment on the date that it was due if not paid, and such a judgment could not be collected more than 20 years later. The court observed that the 20-year limitation period can be extended by a motion filed within the 20-year period, but such a motion never was filed. The case is Adcock v. Commonwealth of Virginia, DSS, DCSE. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Williams v. Williams. The parents in an intact family had a child. In 1994, the grandparents sought visitation with the child. The parents contended that visitation would interfere with their right to autonomy in child rearing. The Supreme Court of Virginia found that the grandparents were not entitled to visitation. In order to require visitation, the court would have to find actual harm to the child's health or welfare without such visitation. Finding none, visitation was not required. The court found that it could not even consider the best interests of the child to determine visitation because it did not first find harm when visitation was not ordered. The child's parents lived together, and there was no evidence of parental abuse or neglect. The parents were mentally, physically, and morally fit and were capable of meeting their child's financial, educational, moral, and social needs. Due to this, the court denied the grandparents' petition for visitation. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Williams v. Williams is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
It's time once again for the weekly question and answer session. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Could you tell us your name and where you're from?
Brittany from Chester.
Welcome to the show, Brittany. What question do we have this week?
I was wondering how, with food stamps, if you have a person that's making $1,400 every 2 weeks but gets child support taken out and other bills, how are they unqualified for food stamps?
And Brittany, how many people are there in the household where the person is making $1,400 every 2 weeks?
There's four of us.
Well, Brittany, amazingly enough, $1,400 gross every 2 weeks, which is a little over $2,800 gross every month, is actually over income for food stamps, which is now called the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Unless the household has an elderly, that is 60 or older, member, or a disabled person, the income limit, the gross income limit before considering any deductions at all, is 130% of poverty. And for a household of four, the maximum gross income for that size household is around $2,400. And of course, $2,800 plus is just over that income limit. And unless there are elderly or disabled people in the household, that's the end of the story. If there were elderly or disabled members in the household, then the gross income limit doesn't apply, and you get to look at those various deductions. There's a standard deduction for each household. There's a deduction for dependent care, that is for caring for a child so somebody can work. There's a deduction for child support. There's a deduction for medical costs. There's a deduction for excess shelter costs. And if you have a household with elderly or disabled people and you're not limited by that gross income limit, then you get to look at all of those deductions. And if you can get your net income down to 100% of poverty, which again for a household of four is around $1,900, then you can qualify for SNAP benefits or food stamps. But unfortunately, if you don't have that elderly or disabled member of the household, you get cut off at gross income. Food stamps, SNAP benefits have a very low gross income limit for most people. And 130% of poverty, as you well know, is not very much money to live on. And nevertheless, if you're over that, you're just income ineligible for SNAP benefits. I know this is not the explanation you wanted, but at least you understand the explanation.
Yes, sir, I do. Thank you very much.
All right. Best of luck. We're here at Dozier Internet Law PC in Glen Allen, Virginia. We are speaking with John Dozier. He's an attorney with the firm, and we will be speaking today about internet defamation. Welcome to the show, John.
Great to be here.
Would you tell our listening audience, John, exactly what is internet defamation?
The general term definition of defamation is speaking words or publishing words that are false that cause damage. And internet, of course, implies that it's related to and communicated over the internet.
So is internet defamation any different than regular defamation, or is it pretty much the same thing, just using a different medium?
It's different. The different aspects of internet defamation relate to the method and manner by which the information is distributed and the methods used to make certain comments public. More public than, for instance, just being carried in the local newspaper, because the only people that are going to learn about that type of defamation are those who read the paper or their friends mention it to them. With the internet, there are ways to distribute the information in a much more broad way so that a comment made today on the internet in here in Richmond could be picked up in Hollywood or New York or Moscow the next hour or so.
And indeed, with the internet, it's essentially available worldwide to anyone who has a computer, and as I understand, it's available essentially for all of eternity, that it really never goes away.
Comments that are made on the internet, the battle for defamation claims that are asserted, often center upon getting rid of the information as much as you can. But it's very difficult. Typically, you are not successful in getting the information scraped off the internet, and it is there forever and ever more.
Now, with standard defamation, print defamation in particular, somebody put something in the newspaper that is defamatory, there are elements to that civil wrong, that tort that you would sue somebody over. Are there similarly elements for internet defamation?
The elements of defamation itself are exactly the same. The complexities in dealing with internet defamation is the challenge of the retraction. If you think about a defamation being published in a newspaper, it's there one day and then gone the next. It's not going to be carried in the newspaper the next day and the day after. On the internet, defamation starts out and it's there, and it becomes more and more powerful the longer it stays on the web. Consequently, the battle is often about, and it gets rather complicated and implicates constitutional issues. The battle is often about how to get the defamatory comments down without impugning free speech rights.
And I guess we'll get to that question in a moment, but I had a sort of a preliminary question. I understand that the service providers, the actual website hosters, are really immune from defamation cases, except for some very unusual instances. Could you elaborate on that?
Congress, back in the 90s, passed a Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which gives those types of websites that are simply intermediaries that are republishing or publishing information provided by third parties, almost virtual blanket immunity from being liable for what's being said. So it creates some complications that traditionally didn't exist, because traditionally before that Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, if you published defamatory information as a publisher, you had liability. That's changed now with the web.
So how do you get at the actual wrongdoer, the person who's actually responsible for putting that information on some website somewhere? I mean, the internet can be largely anonymous. How do you find out who even did it, who to sue?
There's a possibility you can do research and figure out who it is. But typically, if you're dealing with an anonymous attack that's purely anonymous, you're going to file a lawsuit and then issue two sets of subpoenas. The first to the website that's hosting the defamatory comments, and you get the IP address, which is a unique identifier. And then you take the IP address and you determine who the internet service provider is for the IP address and issue a subpoena to the ISP. And then you find out who was using that IP address at the time the posting occurred.
So I gather your initial lawsuit is essentially against a John Doe and possibly against the service provider, or is it just against a John Doe and you use that for the purpose of getting these subpoenas out there?
It's against the John Doe. These are John Doe lawsuits. Once in a while, very rarely, you'll include an ISP, but generally speaking, that information as to whether they have liability or not, or whether they're protected by Section 230, as we discussed, the immunity section, is information that's only developed in the course of litigation, so they might be added to the case down the road. So it's a John Doe lawsuit, issue subpoenas, preferably on an expedited basis if you're in federal court, and within 60 days you ought to know who is responsible for it.
Okay, so you find out who's responsible, and I assume that you file a motion to add them to the lawsuit or to turn the John Doe into a real person, a real name. What do you do if the John Doe is in another state or possibly even another country? Can you reach them?
The answer is yes. Now, if they're in another state, that's a lot easier to reach, because we know that if you have a court judgment, it can be executed against non-resident citizens through processes that exist both in state and federal court. Now, more common is the party who's perpetuating the attack is out of the country. The answer is yes, you can reach them, yes, you can take a judgment, and yes, you can get an injunction where the court here in the United States could order certain things to occur where the information might disappear. But as far as executing on the judgment, and i.e., collecting any kind of monetary judgment or enforcing a subpoena, generally that's going to be totally ineffective.
So what happens if you find that your John Doe is somebody in Russia or China or Nigeria? You're saying that you can't even enforce the subpoena there?
Yes, I'm saying, generally speaking, you cannot enforce a subpoena or a judgment that's been rendered, although you can obtain service. Depending upon whether the country is participating in certain types of treaties, and it gets rather complex, but there are treaties that exist that allow you to serve process internationally. The bigger issue is how you're going to fix the problem of the defamatory information out there on the web, and the answer is it's probably not going to be related to relief against that individual personally. It's going to have to be a court order that directs certain things to occur so that the information then is pulled off the web.
And what type of things would the court order? And I guess would the court be ordering the service provider, who, as you say, is immune from damages but presumably not immune from a court order, would your relief ask the court to order the service provider to get rid of that information?
It could, but the point you raise is a good point, which is that when you have no liability as a service provider, how can the court order you to take an act or to, refrain from doing an act? the hotly contested issue.
Indeed, how can they? And also, wouldn't they at least need to be made a party to the lawsuit for the court's order to compel them to do or to not do something?
Well, most states require that they be given notice. They're not required to be made a party to the suit, but they have to be given notice. Now, if you handle the case in an appropriate way, and the internet service provider or even the search engine that you want to request stop indexing the result, stop showing it as a result, if they're sympathetic or empathetic to your cause and to your position, then they just won't oppose the motion, and you get the court order and you satisfy your needs. But a lot of this is the finesse of how you handle a case. And if you piss off Google, things could get very ugly very quickly. We represent web hosts here too, so we're on the other side of these things too. And I can tell you that a lot of decisions out there are made from an emotional perspective, so you really have to finesse the case very carefully.
It also sounds as if you're entering these cases a lot of times far more on more or less a fishing expedition than you ordinarily would in a typical lawsuit where you at least know who you're suing and what you're suing about. Do you find that to be the case?
There are a lot of fishing expeditions occurring in this space, but the reality is that these attacks come from all directions and seemingly oftentimes with no real basis, no real justifiable reason, and they're rather arbitrary. So, yeah, you're out there fishing, and you don't know what you're going to hook, and it could be a whale or it could be a minnow, and you have no idea, and the first thing you got to do is make sure you're in the right size boat.
A good analogy. And I guess the last question I wanted to ask, you mentioned earlier that sometimes you find you're bumping up against constitutional principles, in particular free speech. Of course, we've had the Supreme Court say recently, essentially, corporations are people, the Citizens United case, and that corporate citizens have essentially the same free speech rights as flesh and blood citizens, and money is speech and speech is money. So when you're doing these internet defamation cases, how do you reconcile that with the constitutional principles?
What is and isn't defamation is defined by the same terms online as it was offline. So that's a rather easy issue because you have 100 years of law that help you define what words are and are not defamatory. Where we run into issues is what relief we're going to get. And a judge who is trying to protect the party that's been attacked, so that would be the plaintiff in a lawsuit who brought the lawsuit, has to be very careful not to put into place an order that is a prior restraint on speech, so that he cannot preclude someone from speaking about another party in the future, per se, but it has to be as narrowly tailored as possible. And you get into a lot of constitutional issues when you're dealing with crafting relief. You get into constitutional issues when we're trying to determine how to identify an anonymous speaker, because once their identity is available, they're out in the open and they're no longer protected by their right to free speech if what they're saying wasn't defamatory. So there are inherent significant constitutional issues that come up in almost every case.
Very good. We have been speaking with John Dozier. He's an attorney at Dozier Internet Law PC in Glen Allen, Virginia. And we have been talking about the new and emerging trend of internet defamation law. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Great being here.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 35.1, which deals with hotel, restaurants, summer camps, and campgrounds. A summer nudist camp for children ages 11 through 17 was conducted at Whitetail Park in 2003. Virginia's General Assembly found out about the camp and amended Code of Virginia Section 35.1-18 to require a parent, grandparent, or legal guardian to accompany each participant, ending plans for the 2004 camp. The park sued in U.S. District Court, which dismissed the case because the park surrendered its license. The appeals court reinstated the lawsuit because the park wanted to conduct future juvenile nudist camps in Virginia. The park apparently changed its mind because the requirements remain as part of the law. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Unjust treatment at work and a wrongful discharge may seem unfair, but do they constitute legally prohibited employment discrimination? Join us next week when private attorney Harris Butler talks about what is and what is not discrimination in employment and how lawyers prove and win these cases in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on April 21, 2010. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.